How much for the Buddha, how much for the Dharma, how much for the Sangha? It's nice to see y'all here. I really mean that. So, we are studying precepts right now. And one thing that sort of bubbled up, and maybe it was the first class, that was a surprise to a lot in the room was how the first three, the pure precepts, relate to the bodhisattvas who are up here. See? But it's a thing. So, cease from evil, release all self-attachment is the first, and that's associated with kanzan, is all accepting mind. Do only good, take selfless action is associated with Fugen, Samantabhadra, who in our hall we have like Fudo standing in for Fugen, which is just sort of a lineage specific thing because our line passed through Sojiji in Japan. And then the third, do good for others, embrace all things and conditions, symbolized by Manjushri, Bodhisattva of Wisdom. So those, they each have their own flavor and they each relate to those precepts in a way. So take that for your own exploration, but we're going to use the second one as the launch point for the talk today. This is about the second pure precept and the practice of transforming karma. Samantabhadra is one of the mahasattvas. We say all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas. So a mahasattva is like a super bodhisattva. And there's several of them, but there's not a huge number of them. So like these three would all kind of be considered mahasattvas. They're like, more important. He's known as Fugen in Japanese, that translates to universal virtue in English. Samantabhadra is, I'm gonna say Samantabhadra rather than Fugen, even though it's more syllables, it kind of like, it's more what I'm familiar with. Often is pictured riding a six-tusked elephant. Sometimes the elephant has six legs. That's a reference to the six paramitas. Samantabhadra is often shown in a triad with Shakyamuni and Avalokiteshvara, or sometimes in just a pair with Manjushri. And is a real prominent figure in the Avatamsaka Sutra and shows up in several other Mahayana sutras, Lotus, Mahavarachana, etc. As a bodhisattva, Samantabhadra is associated with a devotional kind of practice, with loving action, with the paramitas, but especially the paramitas of conduct, ethics and patience. He's known for the 10 vows, which have a strongly devotional feel, which is a little interesting for such a for a mahasattva, an exalted figure. So I want to read those. And please notice when I do, like, if and how these resonate with you, and insofar as they don't, how you might characterize them. Just initial impulse. So the 10 vows of Samantabhadra. To pay homage to all the Buddhas. To glorify the qualities of all the Tathagatas. To make ample offerings to all the Buddhas. To confess and repent of all one's misdeeds. To rejoice in the merits of others. To always request the preaching of the Dharma. To entreat enlightened beings to remain in the world. To always study the teachings of the Buddha. to always respond to sentient beings, to always dedicate the merit to all sentient beings. So just take a moment to sift and sort. Does it feel relevant? Does it feel obvious? Kind of weird? Too soft? Unbelievable? Scary? What happens? Another characteristic of Samantabhadra is his view. So whereas Avalokiteshvara has a special capacity to notice suffering, to attune to the cries of the world, and Manjushri has this strong wisdom perspective of non-duality, of cutting through delusion. So Samantabhadra is like, their superpower is seeing the complexity of the world, right? Letting it all in, all the moving layers, all the causal relationships. This is often depicted with some kind of a visual or spatial metaphor. Samantabhadra has a kaleidoscopic view or a holographic view. He is at home in the infinite mandala of existence, for example. Indra's net is another one, another image of interdependence where each jewel on this vast universe encompassing net reflects all the other jewels, and each jewel is undisturbed and doesn't interfere with the image, right? So that's also associated with Samantabhadra. Dogen's metaphor of seeing the moon reflected in the drop of water on a blade of grass also shows this. It's illustrating how a finite, limited, individual perspective can experience the whole, can partake of realization. The absolute shines through the relative. The size of the moon doesn't disturb the dewdrop, and the dewdrop doesn't restrict the moon. All of that Samantabhadra flavor. Who we are is not separate. Who we are actually is immersed in everything. It is reflected by everything. And Samantabhadra is exemplifying this broad, peaceful state that sees that clearly, that doesn't react, that isn't overwhelmed by reality. And that view translates to loving action. And if you see like the one phrase version of Samantabhadra, it's Samantabhadra loving action, basically, something to that effect. Do only good, not from obligation, but just because with this view, from this perspective, that's what's most obvious, what's most natural, what's most authentic. There's a real link between this view of incredible beauty, nuance, subtlety, and complexity of the world and loving action. It's very easy to try to constrain our model of reality, right? To look at a moment in time, or to look at a place, or to look at an intention or a person. Samantabhadra explodes that, right? A line of dominoes falling into each other, right, is a depiction of causality. But it's wildly misleading because it's such a simple system, right? It gives us this idea that there's a single cause, boop, and a single effect, boop, and we can capture that, we can model it, we can understand it. And in practice, in life, it's never that simple. I'm irritated because you were late, right? I mean, that's like a domino, right? We might be feeling irritated and someone might be late, but there's hundreds of past events that are each exerting some kind of influence on that current situation for both parties. And they're all weighted differently depending on the situation, the context. And each moment of expression over time of that situation is dependent on the ones that came before and are projecting the ones that come after. I'm irritated because you were late is a fiction, is a fantasy. And it reinforces a dualistic, binary, simplistic view of the world. It looks easier, it looks safer at first because it's more straightforward to affect it, and we like to be in control. If we don't feel momentarily better, we can reinterpret the story and add a little more incompetence or malice to the lateness and to justify the irritation, right? Suffering. I'm not recommending that, I'm just noting. Most of us laughed. We recognize. So if we look at a table with this line or curve of dominoes all ready to go, with Samantha Bhadra's perspective, like we might see also the intention of the person who set it up and the person perceiving it and the makeup of the table and the manufacture of the dominoes and the temperature and moisture in the air and et cetera, et cetera. We could describe it in physical, chemical, biological terms. It's wild. And it's all dominoes booping. Part of our meal verse says, we reflect on the effort that brought us this food and consider how it comes to us. Right, the sun, the weather systems, the farmer, the graphic designer in the marketing department, the packaging, the cook, the digestive enzymes, the stomach acid, like blah, 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 blah. The goal is not to come up with the list before you start eating. We don't have to, it's not possible to hold it all in working memory. The point is that we appreciate the meal, that we cultivate gratitude and clarity. We're priming that particular pump. And remembering that there's more to it helps. We say that verse in this cultural, situational context in which we're under a fair amount of pressure to reduce the amount of information that we're responsible for, right? Binary either-or thought is a lot easier. We're trained by algorithms to click and swipe our way into less nuanced views. The domino falls or it doesn't. Someone is late or they're on time. I bought the coffee, I get to drink it. It takes an emotional and cognitive energy to notice tropical deforestation in my cup of coffee. When life is a swirling kaleidoscope, it's easy to feel overwhelmed. It's easier to reach for the security of identity than to be completely intimate, completely available to be affected by the moment. And Samantha Bhadra is here for that dazzling display. This isn't a knock on simplicity. I like simplicity. I think there's something super wholesome about it. I also think there's something really wholesome about being able to deeply notice and delve into complexity. I love simple tasks. Part of what I love about raking gravel or planing wood or chopping a carrot is that there's room to keep noticing, right? It's easy to anchor in task and not in narrative. And so the experience isn't static. It keeps evolving, it keeps transforming, it keeps deepening. There's more there as I get absorbed into it. Taking refuge in reality goes deeper. Part of Samantha Bhadra's loving action is taking deep responsibility for cleaning our karma. Do only good means we're not leaking reactivity out into the world. Do only good means we're healing our wounds and finding helpful ways of perceiving and interacting with and affecting the world. And that's not a a thing you just do, right? It's a marathon. I notice in myself that sometimes I just don't respond when something goes wrong, right? There's too many layers. Perhaps I can see the layers, but I just don't really trust myself to convey it if I tried to express it, or I don't feel that I'm seeing enough of it, or that someone else in the situation, in the mandala, is seeing a different enough selection of truths that it's going to be too confusing, too costly to try to harmonize those views. I just want to drink my coffee. And there's a paralysis that can happen as part of adding awareness to a system. If we're taking on this work of cleaning up our karmic inheritance, of reducing the harm we cause in the world, it comes down to adding more and more awareness. The paralysis isn't the goal, but it is part of the process. If your car needs repair and you're qualified to do it, perhaps you take the engine apart, right? Like, that's part of the process. It's good, it's responsible, and while it's outside of the car, like, you're not driving anywhere. And that's how karmic work happens. There's something grinding where it shouldn't be. Maybe it's the brake pads. Maybe it's feeling like we have to prove our worthiness. Maybe it's our temperamentalness about timing, or numb about our impact on the global economy. There's a noise happening that shouldn't be. And so we stop, we take things apart, we try to investigate, we try to add awareness, add clarity. Sometimes we have to take a lot apart, sometimes not so much. The more chronic the karmic jangle, like, the longer the period in which something's disassembled. And during that time, we don't have our accustomed access to our capacity. We've had a lot of practice doing things a certain way, getting through life with this set of strategies, with this set of, tactics. If we stop doing it like that, we're going to regress by some measures. And, this is a familiar thing to observe in practice. People start working on precepts, and all of a sudden they start noticing the ways in which they're not quite living up to their ideals. People sit down for a sesshin and they notice, oh my, like, that is how busy my mind is. Right? It didn't feel that busy before. People move into residency or they take on a new practice position, and suddenly their car doesn't run as well. Yeah, so it's adding awareness. And part of that is undoing what has been working, what we've been getting away with. The cost of it working is suffering, right? So it's a good trade. I do want to acknowledge that there are ways of not responding that are just an escape, right? That are just resistance. When it's not that your karmic engine is like hanging from a chain in the garage, but you just don't want to drive. And so that's not what I'm talking about. This Dharma talk is not about that. That's a separate Dharma talk. This is assuming you are trying, you are like leaning into that responsibility to cause less harm and feel more ease. And if that's the case, you're taking things apart, you're trying to fix them, it's okay. Part of what Samantabhadra models is humility and ease with this process. Remember the vows. Like, he may be a Mahasattva, but those are the vows of a novice. It's a lot of requesting teaching, of appreciating others. We have to be willing to be a junior, to make mistakes, to be inadequate, in order to see our situation clearly, accurately, to be able to appreciate its complexity. Appreciating that complexity, like, that gives us the nuanced awareness, right, that allows change. We need clarity. Around here, we have a lot of forms that are different ways of showing the Sangha who we are, right? There's these kind of expressive rituals that happen every now and then, like fusatsu or term vows or closing statements after something intense happens. There's interactive ceremonies like shosan and mando and daisan. There's daily activities like daisan or like sanzen or work circle or even communal meals. We're seen, right? And it's easy to tighten up in those situations, to want to manage how others perceive us. And humility and ease are really helpful there, right? Samantabhadra's example. It's clear to him that it's not about us. It's not about any one answer, any one view. It's too complex, it's too subtle, it's too quick. No single moment of time is going to accurately define us or the situation. So there's a way into just relaxing and just noticing this snapshot. What is it? Who am I? Because we keep doing it, we'll get a lot of those snapshots. It'll mean something over time. Dominoes won't capture it, but there is meaning there. It is emergent. There's something that happens when there's enough authenticity, enough immediacy in a container, and everyone benefits. So that formal version is just a supported version of what's happening in mindfulness every day. Right? Having it be witnessed, having it be named and witnessed and underlined, right, makes it more obvious to us. But ultimately, the same thing is happening. It's this intention to bring more awareness to our life. So as we do that, we're going to hit pockets of no, of resistance, of pushing away, of clouding over, right? We have these corners, we have these like spots that we don't want to put awareness. And I think Samantabhadra is a good example there, like that trusting that he can be completely at ease with this. I think it's really useful, for me, I find times in my life where I saw through it, right? Where I wasn't confused by that dark corner. One of them for me, especially if I'm I can use it from a bunch of different entrances, actually. But appreciating the natural world is a huge doorway. I have an image of walking through the savannah out here and just the incredible richness of plant life. And it's all things that are 8 to 16 inches tall. It's all or smaller. It's little things, and it's just like the array of colors and textures and shapes in 3 or 4 feet. It's just incredible. And there's so much beauty in that. And it's a doorway into this is right. This is immaculate, right? There's something so beautiful about that. And it kind of resets. there's a lot to be frustrated with. There's a lot to be aggrieved with. There's ginormous problems in the world right now. And that's also true. Humility and ease lead to trust. That moment when I had that experience, that particular insight, was it was quite a while ago. We were like in our first 2 years on this site. And we'd been doing, like, and that was like the first like summer that things were blooming, that there was actually like natives happening there. And part of it was that we had just devoted like a tremendous amount of person hours to like preparing that area. And so there was a real appreciation of just like how much is invisible in that, how much like we reflect on the effort that brought us this food and consider how it comes to us. I was quite intimate with the effort which had brought us that food. Part of the beauty of Dogen's image of moon on a dewdrop is that the dewdrop of our everyday conditioned inadequate life does not restrict the situation. The dewdrop of whatever you just read in the news does not restrict that situation. We don't constrain it. We have full access to that view despite our limits, despite our karma. Trust the richness. Every molecule, every perception, every impulse is part of it and is affecting it. Wow.
If you are in the Zendo and you have a question, please raise your hand. Say your name when you are given the mic, and please hold it close to your mouth, and then state your question. If you are on Zoom, you can type your name into the chat, and the co-host will unmute you so you can ask your question, or you can type your question into the chat, and the co-host will say it for you.
Are you laughing because I'm going to ask, where were the mushrooms?
Yes.
No. I actually had a couple of stories that I tell myself that I believe are true as to reasons why I don't look more deeply into things. Like, why do I not want to spend the time to look deeply into this moment and process my karma? And there's two stories that come up a lot, and one of them is that takes energy and effort, and I'm tired and I need to rest.
Yeah.
And the other one is I have things that have to be done. Like, my kids need food, and the house needs to be cleaned, and they need to get to bed, and I need to blah, blah, blah. And I'm just curious, like, those are the two stories that just hold so much conviction that prevent me from doing it, and I'm curious what you have to say about that.
So, sample size of, you know, what, 65 people? How many people recognize those two voices intimately? Okay. Yeah, like that's how it is. I mean, that's like we are conditioned. We are like in this relative world, and there's more that needs to be done than can happen. And like some of it can, like some of it dovetails easily and some of it doesn't. And so like there is like we get better at finding ways to like work it in, and like awareness is not finite, but attention is, right? Like our ability to go deeper is limited, and it's limited by our immediate circumstance, and that's just real. And I think like that's part of this like humility and ease that Samantabraj is showing us is like, hey, like that's okay. Like we have a room full of people who all experienced that. I didn't see anybody. I mean, there are probably people who didn't hold their hands, but it looked like a lot of hands. And this is also a room full of people who I know is doing amazing work. internally. So it's not like, yes, it's an obstacle, but it's not, it's a soft obstacle, right? Like, we're moving through it. It works. We need a certain amount of like grit.
Hi, thank you for your talk. This is Alice. I think for me is I made up a lot of stories, and then I have another voice trying to tell me. So it's like, how do I be more aware of my feeling? But the other side is more like a parents, a mom thing. So it's like, which side should I listen to?
Well, I would say, like, give yourself that moment of cease from evil, right? Give yourself that moment of pause and notice, like don't look for the answer or the recycled answer or like, you know, but like actually right now, what's more relevant? Like, what is this situation, including yourself, because we're all interconnected, like, what is being asked for here? I mean, it's similar to the answer to Jen's question, is like, you know, we just keep doing our best, and yeah, like, it does happen, it does work.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, it's Sonia. I liked the example of the dominoes falling and everything else that's really happening. Mm-hmm. Can you expand the you are late situation in a similar way? I could use some help with that.
Yeah. So, like, yeah, it's very comforting to have a simple, like, that's the problem. And, like, there's a particular self who sees that. And that self, like, there's a certain amount of, like valence, like charge that comes from the momentary situation. And then there's all the other situations that like mirror that, that mimic that, that like have kind of set the stage for it over the course of our life. And all of that's part of it. And that's for me, that's for the other person, that's for people perceiving it. All of it is playing into that, to this like mandala, which just appeared. And all the pieces, like, you know, see each other to a greater or lesser extent, or think they do, right? And so it's just the incredibly, like, complex, like in Indra's net, like, set of mirrors that are, like, just bouncing off each other. And we don't, like, the goal isn't to try to, like, represent it accurately. But, like, for me, if I'm, like, if I have that thought, like, I'm irritated because you're late, like, one of my practices, which I've had for a long time because irritation is, you know, an easy one for me, is when that mind of blame, like, surfaces, to come up with more than one interpretation. So the, like, whatever it was, however I filled in that sentence, I come up with another one. And it doesn't have to be, it doesn't matter if it's credible, right? It doesn't, like, Zonio's late because aliens, right? Like, it's fine, right? Like, it works because, like, to my, like, my actual, like, somatic sense of the situation, like, there's another possibility. It doesn't have to be rational.
I've heard you say that before. It's very helpful. But putting it in the context of this talk, in the framework of interdependence, I'm kind of making that connection there, that there's all these other factors that could have happened and that are part of the mandala.
And that's part of the humility. It's like, I'm not up for understanding that, for representing that, for like having the model of reality. That's not in my job description. And like, it's over my pay grade. And so I don't take that on. And that's one way I remind myself of that.
That's very helpful. Thank you.
Hi, this is Genko. I'm continuing on with Jen's question, and because the question that came up for me was actually very similar in that when I went through the whole explosion practice, rebuilding the engine practice, I was here with a lot of support and a lot of permission to like take time out, all of that kind of stuff. And when I work with people in prison, now they have parts of that because their engine has like been like demolished, and there they are, and somebody else is taking care of all of the life stuff. Mm-hmm. So there's at least the opportunity there, but there's not the safety and support mm-hmm. in the same way. Mm-hmm. So I've been thinking about this as we've been talking about this, and like what is required. And I had another thing that came up for me, that it was about the Dalai Lama. Somewhere along the line, when Pam was dying, we did a lot of talking about dying and what that process was. People were wondering, well, what happens if you're sedated when you're dying? And the Dalai Lama's answer to that was, the work goes on anyway, underneath that. So, which was very reassuring, because, you know, you don't know what's going to happen there when mm-hmm. you're, you know, in the hospital, whatever. They're going to do pain meds and stuff. And so I think what I heard you say was, the work is still going on underneath all of the restrictions, all of the have-tos, all of the other things that we have to do. Mm-hmm. And I find that reassuring, and because I can see it. I can see it with people, even if it's not safe. They are still doing the work. And even if, like you say, people are pressed with things to do, you can see the results of the work. Mm-hmm. So we do the work however we can, and it isn't all exactly intentional or conscious.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think we have, like, you know, like we're very good at coming up with a sense of, like, here's my trajectory, here's where I'm going, this is how it's going to look. And practice is really quite subterranean, and we see parts of it. We see ways in which we're affected, and there's a lot going on. And so, like, I've certainly spent time in practice, like, clinging to particular things that I could notice and control and affect, and like certain aspects of my practice, like how much zazen or whatever. And it's really uncomfortable. And I really, practice is a lot more fun as I release that mm-hmm. sense of control there and really take refuge in this trust. Like I know I'm working at it. I know this is working, and I don't have to be able to describe it. I mean, to some extent I do, because I'm up here right now, but I'm pointing towards it. Yeah.
Hi, this is Mikio. So when I see people around me who I know, it's easy to see the complexity. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say, oh, this person is good and this person is bad. Mm-hmm. But when the bigger, you know, the prominent figures in the country and stuff, actually it's much easier to say, oh, this one is bad. And, you know, and part of it, I think, is if you say this person is bad or good, you can get the sense of belonging. You feel like you belong to this big group of people who have this opinion. Mm-hmm. And but at the same time, I feel like I do that a lot too. So, but now I feel like that's probably not particularly a good thing to do. But at the same time, sense of belonging is pretty important. So especially in a wild world where you don't really know where you are, mm-hmm. But once you have opinion about something, then it's like, okay, there's a friend. So what do you think about that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I figured that would come up today. you know, I feel like it's very similar to Alice's question, actually, of like, yeah, sure, like belonging's important. Clarity is also important. Equanimity is also important. Like, land for a moment. Like, just have that moment of cease and notice what is real right there. And it's not who you are. It's just in that moment, this is what's in front of me. Right, so it's, and what we find is that, like, we really have a lot of diversity in our perspective on this. Like, there's a lot that goes on over time. It all may have a particular flavor, but be interested in that. Because part of what happens is, like, when we see it, when you can disconnect it a little bit, when you can see the component parts, the tendency to identify is much less, right? And so the suffering created is much less.
Thank you.
This is Sarah. I really liked the imagery of a simple life, living simply, and also being in the moment when something comes towards you, mm-hmm. whether it's an irritation or even happy thoughts, even like looking down at the ground, like maybe you did when a kid and you're fascinated by what is going on. And I give myself a lot of space to do that again as I'm getting older, because things are slowing down and you get more forgetful, and you have to forgive yourself sometimes, because it's hard. It's like, I can't remember the name of that person, or I can't remember the name of that plant, or whatever it is. So a lot of the practice for me is forgiving. Mm-hmm. And then also forgiving others, because you don't know why they're late. Mm-hmm. And it is kind of fun and interesting to make up a story. Oh, you know, I don't know why that person's honking in traffic, you know? Why is that person on my tail in traffic? Sometimes I'm sitting in traffic and it's like a symphony, and then this person plays, and then the tuba comes in, and then you're just like, okay, what's gonna happen next? And it's kind of fun, and then you kind of take your mind off that it's irritating. But it really works. I start singing, okay, next, and then you go, and then is it my turn yet? And but it's just a lot of looking at things from a different perspective, mm-hmm. and trying to kind of laugh with life, I guess. And then a lot of forgiveness. For self first, I think, sometimes, and then towards others.
One thing I would say about that is, looking at the ground is simple and also incredibly complicated, right? Like there's so much going on in, like, the first 2 inches of ground, and and the thing is, like, I think part of it is, like, the ground, we basically trust. We basically see that, like, oh, there's an order to this, right? Like, there's a way it is. There's a way it works. And so all that complexity, insofar as we can access it, insofar as we are available for it, like, it's not confusing, right? Whereas, you know, there are some things that are complex and are confusing. And, like, there's not that naturalness to it. There's not, like, there's a lot more reactive conditioning guiding it. And yeah, very different response, visceral response to it when we perceive it. I feel like that's a useful cue in myself of, like, is there a sense of ease noticing something versus is there a sense of like pulling back, contracting?
Thank you.
On Zoom, there's a question from Oren. We have an echo, so can someone do something about that? Anyway, she says...
Go ahead.
Thank you. When I worked with Genko in the women's prison, I resounded with her insistence that we just keep on sitting, and all of practice was represented by sitting. It may not seem as though anything is happening, but one day you notice that your response to a challenge manifests in an entirely different way from how you might have responded to a similar challenge at some earlier time. I have experienced that, as I'm sure many have. Isn't that evidence that the work goes on undercover, so to speak? And does that work for everyone, or does it need a trigger such as taking the precepts?
Thanks, Oren. Yeah, good example and nice description of it. I think there's a way in which, like, everything is moving towards enlightenment. Like, I have a pretty optimistic view there, but I'm not, I don't think it's happening on my timeline or in a perceivable time scale, right? Like, it's bigger than that. And so, and I think, I don't believe that practice is just automatic. Something's required. It's tragic, and I've seen people, like, you know, spin on their hook for decades and not change. And it doesn't have to be like that. And I think that's real, like, individual. That's unique. Like, what's needed there? I precepts are great. They will help some people, and they may not be a window for everybody. I think that's more personal. What helps someone access the possibility of transforming? I've got two more here in a row.
Well, I liked in your talk the image of Samantabhadra not being overwhelmed by the everything. And but I am overwhelmed, and, like, particularly, you know, you mentioned the dewdrop of the news, and my experience this morning is, like, seeing that and seeing the moon through it a little bit, you know, like, that's also part of it. And that's an overwhelming feeling. That's, like, overwhelming to experience, and I'm not sure what to do, but I like having this this image. But I don't know if there's anything else you have to offer.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I think you're voicing something which is really, again, like, everyone would raise their hand. And it was, you know, like, that was quite prominent for me, like, writing this talk this morning. What is appearing for me, and I've tried to shake it a couple times, and I haven't, so I'm just gonna say it, and we'll see. But I feel like the image of the elephant is important there. There's just something about it, like so massive, so graceful, like, just a really different way of being in the world. And, you know, that's what's carrying Samantabhadra forward.
Yeah, that works. I was thinking about that image with the elephant. I was like, yeah, the elephant. So it makes sense in a way. Thank you.
Hi, Grant here. Going back to the karmic engine and working on cleansing karma, I'm someone, I know a lot of people who would kind of beat up on themselves over past actions. And I'm just interested to explore the notion of, like, conceptually, is karma considered a punishing force? And conceptually, would that be an internal punishing force or an external force?
Oh, yeah. Like, no division. Like, it's just... So, if I've got... you know, if I've habitually been irritated by people who are late, right, like, that's an uncomfortable experience. Irritation is not pleasant. Like, I might spin it, you know, I might try to convince myself that I like it. But no, it's not a pleasant sensation, like, factually. And that inevitably spreads out into the world. Like, that's bouncing off people around me. That's, you know, affecting future interactions. And, oh, it's just a mess. So yeah, both, for sure. Part of what that, one thing I want to just pull out there is that often when we're thinking about, like, oh, I want to fix this in my karmic engine, we're thinking about, like, something late in the game, right? Like the expressed, like, ah, why are you late, right? Like, that's what's most visible. That's what causes the most obvious damage around us. And, farther upstream, the farther upstream you go, like, the more effective it is. I mean, maybe not, that's not all the way true, because at some point you can't sense it. But, I find, like, the most effective place to work is how we perceive the world, right? Like, what are the, like, implicit beliefs that shape this situation that makes me say they're late or I'm irritated? Those are, like, the building blocks of identity, and that's what we're trying to actually, like, take apart. If we're just focusing on the, the sound, right? Something's screeching in the engine. We might just insulate it, and it's still going on. Like, we want to get to the root of, like, why is that happening? And mostly that's perception. All right, I think the kids are loose and time to go.